this point, can all the speakers in our session come up forward, take your places? Assume those mics are on. And I think it's really heroic. I know I couldn't do a talk in 5 or 7 minutes, so we should give them a round of applause for staying on time. Al is covering a number of Canadian provinces, so so as moderator, I get to ask the first question, and then we'll certainly open it up. Number, you did comment on, since the session is called Causes and Indigenous Status and Trends and Causes, a number of you did comment on issues of nutrient loading and bases. The other curious thing is in various places, I mean, the general trend is decline across the board. A couple of places where it's actually there's been some growth within the general context of decline. Could you comment on those areas of where it's increased and what we can learn from that?
Well, yeah. In Rhode Island, we did see some increase again. Again, I wouldn't say that the increase is as dramatic as, 100 to 400 acres. Again, I think the 100 was probably an underestimate, but it's likely the water quality. I mean, there has been improvements to clean up the bay, particularly discharges from the North Providence River, and so it's water quality improvements. And hopefully, there has been, and since 96, there still has been that line at the north end of Prudence Island where you won't see any eelgrass north of that. And that line has not moved in the past 10 years, even though we've seen, at least in the lower bay, we've seen improvements, which are likely improvements in water quality. But the hope is that the CSO tunnel and the decreased nutrients from the wastewater treatment plants would be a point source for Rhode Island. So I think it will be years from now before we see that. But, I think the news will be good once we see that line moving up.
I think, in spite of the fact that my report was gloomy, there are some bright spots, and unfortunately they're mostly related to human improvements, but I think that underlines the nature of eelgrass in that it's struggling hard now in these degraded situations, but when, for whatever reason, that light attenuation is removed, it rebounds extremely quickly. And in several cases in Massachusetts, I spoke of Gloucester Harbor and the river, and there are others in coastal ponds and in Martha's Vineyard and along the Buzzards Bay, that when there is improvement, things are going to get better. And that's a positive note.
I think I, skipped over a lot of things, trying to show you a large section of the Maine coast. One of the things that I've noticed is that along the more open coastal areas, and this is no big surprise to most all of you who've been working with seagrasses and eelgrass in particular, that comparing the 90s and the present decade, many of those beds are very stable along the open coast. The polygons are nearly identical. When you go inland into some of the shallow estuaries, there's more variation and change. It is puzzling, just as an example in Casco Bay, where there's an area of loss, fairly significant loss, right next to another area of very significant gain. So the controlling factors there, obviously are fairly complex. There are a number of locations, though, and McCoy Bay, even though the information that I've presented is dated now. John Soles, who's here, has flown over, looked at McCoy Bay and Little Bay, there's another embayment further on up where. Near these inner bay and inner estuary areas, there does appear to be not just some stability, but also increase, which is encouraging. So.
Anybody else?
Well, yes, in Connecticut, at least, Mumford Cove, in the late 90s, had no eelgrass, and they moved the sewage treatment plant out to another watershed, and the area there flourished. But again, there is some interannual variability because it shows an 11-acre loss over maybe out of 60 acres, whatever it was. So you're going to see fluctuations that are natural as well as the human-induced causes that keep us from being able to have eelgrass. I think the other area of great concern that might actually be, when I was a younger person, the Little Narragansett Bay was loaded with eelgrass, and right now there are sort of two issues. We have sewage treatment plants in Westerly, Rhode Island, and Stonington, Connecticut, contributing to some water quality issues on the inner part of that bay, as well as we have a huge population of mute swans that, until we get Connecticut convinced that they have to do something about controlling the mute swan population, I don't think we could ever bring anything back there. We'll just graze it.
Why don't I turn it over to the audience? So I saw Phil's hand first. So do you need to speak louder? Give you the mic.
First, a comment, then a question. The comment is, between Fred's talk and some of your discussion on water quality, I don't need to give my talk tomorrow. You guys have it all. The question goes to a point that Fred made earlier, and I'm wondering if there's any power in looking at this from a regional perspective and getting policy changes as opposed to doing it state by state.
That's why it's good to have the bureaucrats here. No, I think it's great. I mean, I think that's really, if something like that is possible, that definitely what we should think about, maybe spend some time tomorrow talking about how to do some sort of regional assessment, maybe a regional paper on what's going on throughout this whole West Atlantic region, point out the problems. I mean, we're seeing pretty much decline across the line, and the decline certainly outweighs the increase.
I had a question for Al. I was struck by the green crab issue, and wondering if there's a fishery for green crab at all. Down in Massachusetts, they fish them somewhat for bait, for conch and lobster and so forth, and you know, if you get the fishermen on them, they'll wipe them out. So.
There has been some research into what potentially could be done with green crab in Canada, and they were looking at meals, like a green crab meal, etc. Well, I'll talk more about green crab tomorrow, but in some of the estuaries where they invaded, the populations have since declined. The predator-prey relationships have been established, so green crabs have, their impact has been reduced, but that is one thing that they have been looking at, is some sort of commercial fishery for green crab. Currently, right now, they're not regulated, so the fishermen are free to do with green crab what they want, and they like it just fine that way. So I'm not quite sure where DFO is going with a commercial fishery for green crab.
Anybody else?
Well, I see in the southern end of the zone that the Asian shore crab has really taken over the niche of the green crab hat. Hmm. So either you wait a while, or we'll have to see what actual impact the Asian shore crab has on eelgrass.
We've seen that Narragansett Bay issue.
Like the eelgrass?
Yeah. Particularly the smaller and short bits. Especially like during periods of, we saw during the heat wave in particular, just the higher temperatures reduce their gestation period, and we just, a huge boom, and sometimes wiped out some of the short bits. So, yeah. Depending on where you are in the bay,
I know we could wait until tomorrow, but could you put some of us out of our misery on what the mechanism is with the green crab problem? in a nutshell, and then we'll get the full story from Al tomorrow?
Well, in the estuaries where it has been studied intensively, the green crabs were just, their main impact was through bioturbation in terms of just digging up the eelgrass, cutting the shoots, etc.
And that's pretty common. I mean, when they came into New Hampshire in the 50s, they did the same thing. There was a documented impact on eelgrass, and it lasts for 10, 15 years, and then it dwindles away. So there's hope.
And I guess I should add that the mechanisms in Canada are no different than what was experienced in New England. It's just that these are invading species, and their populations just grow exponentially for a number of years. And as the talk will discuss tomorrow, in the estuaries where it has been studied, the populations have since declined, and the eelgrass is starting to recover.
You need more birds there, you think? Congrats.
We'll trade you some geese. We've been talking this morning about historical declines in seagrass, and Fred gets excited about data going back to 1982, which doesn't seem so historical in my age. And I think, Chris, you had data back to 1930, which does, however, predate me. Does anybody have any information on the 1830s or the 1730s or the 1630s? Not era photographs, mind you. But is there any historical evidence from anecdotal stuff from colonial or pre-colonial? Because we see declines in baselines here, but to really get people on board and to really understand the changes in coastal ecosystems, we need to go back, you know, like Jim Carlton does, way before 1930.
Yeah, one of the maps I have showing the historical eelgrass beds in Narragansett Bay, that's from an estimate from late 1800s, early 1900s. It's again, we don't have the maps, but you have anecdotal evidence.
And that comes from NOAA, or actually National Ocean Service back then, boat chiefs, where they would sound and mark on them where seagrasses were, eelgrass were, and at least for much of the U.S., you can go to the National Archive and put your hand on the boat sheet.
So how much has the loss been since 1830 or
1730? Well, I only did it in Narragansett Bay, and there's big parts of Narragansett Bay where the grass that was mapped is now under.
One comment I would add on that is they did do an analysis, I think, in France, looking at historical nautical charts on eelgrass, historical abundance and distribution of eelgrass, and looked at the spatial accuracy of it, and it was very limited, the accuracy of those maps. And from my perspective, I think we can document enough near-time change in eelgrass to cause policy changes if desired.
If you want to talk historical, there's a group in Maine working with Joe Kelly that have pulled up a core off the Isle of Shoal, off the Acadia, and they've just dated the eelgrass at 10,000 years. Well, it's been around here a long time. But we haven't quite got the distribution yet.
So to make the link between what we've all been talking about and what the managers or the bureaucrats can do about it, I'm wondering what you think about restoration as mitigation right now, transplanting eelgrass into areas that have declined. Is that still the best way to go, or should we be focusing mitigation on reducing nitrogen?
Yes. I think there's a place for restoration, and if the water quality is good enough and there's no immediate thing that eliminated it, preventing it from coming back, then there's certainly places where it won't come back on its own, and restoration is necessary. But the larger scale restoration, probably beyond the scope of most mitigation efforts, is to reduce the nitrogen.
To follow up on Fred's comments, as somebody who mostly does restoration work, we're having great successes in Long Island Sound where Tom's group has seen some increases naturally. So we're working many miles away from those locations. So we're actually seeing higher densities in our restoration plots than the reference sites we use as the model for those sites. So it can work. It does work. If we're patient enough and water quality doesn't decrease, then maybe it'll happen on its own. But is that 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, several lifetimes away? We don't know, because these are high-energy shores. You're not going to get seeds there. You're not going to get plants to root there on their own. So in select locations, I think restoration, proactive restoration, don't get involved in mitigation, but proactive restoration seems to make sense to me. And try to, you know, any port in a storm, basically, is what we're looking at. Try to keep the grass coverage where we can, when we can. In other areas like the Peconic that I talked about, it doesn't work. It's just not working for us. So the grass is dying, restoration's not working, and the South Shore, it's a mix of the two. So I think there is a place for restoration, proactive restoration, mitigation. I don't know, really. I'd like to see water quality improve, but that would basically, you know, get my job done that much quicker.
Some of the conflicts I see with that is, in a lot of cases, you'll have a specific amount in both acreage and dollars that a particular project can use. And in some cases, yes, improving water quality would be a better situation, but that's tenfold. The cost to actually really be able to implement that is largely beyond this one project. So there's, you know, that's always an issue.
And then the other area is protecting what we have. And the most proactive in the southern New England, New York area is New York State has a New York State task force, a eelgrass task force. The legislature asked them to come up with legislation for them eventually to protect eelgrass in New York State waters. So that's probably a move in the right direction, but we need to do that state by state.
Yeah, that's a good question. I thought a fair amount about this myself over the last few years. And, you know, very definitely water quality is one of the primary issues, and any restoration effort, you know, you don't want to detract from what needs to be a continuous effort to improve water quality in some areas. But in terms of in many locations in Maine, I think that the educational and the potential science aspect of restoration efforts is something that should be overlooked. There's a nice effort that's going on up in Frenchman Bay at Hadley Point, which has some of those components to it. And also, I think something to look to in the future is strategic value of restoration. Looking at Penobscot Bay, I'm saying in some areas, you know, where are the seed sources going to come from? So, you know, potentially strategic restoration that could result in reseeding beyond just the immediate restoration area. Okay.
Lane.
Each one of you pointed out that the challenges of creating a map, an eelgrass map, and then going back some period of time later and creating another one and making comparisons when you're faced with challenges of changing methods, or even if you're using the same method, each map is still just an N of one. You know, replicate the mapping effort. And some of you addressed that. Fred, you talked about giving up perhaps some precision, but getting very frequent efforts. Charlie, you talked about accuracy assessments. There were various approaches to it. I guess I came away thinking that some approach to put numeric error estimates on any given acreage report would be valuable. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are, both on utility and feasibility of doing that.
Well, photo interpretation by itself, as was spoken here today, is not as accurate as we would like it, because just the limitations of any imagery block the signatures of places that we're looking at. So I think any type of mapping does need a rigorous ground-truthing element to it. And I also think it's important to try to validate the thematic accuracy of that data from which the acreages and the tables get put together. So I agree that there's a need to try to validate that, especially as these numbers, at least in Massachusetts' case, are pretty upsetting. And it's important to try to validate them as best we can, because they are going to be used. They're being used in our state to force water quality treatment plants, communities that I work in all over the state, the coastal state towns. It's like building a new high school but not getting a high school, and the taxpayers really don't see any benefit for their $90 million. And so that's why in Massachusetts we're trying to validate our data so that we can use improved eelgrass resource acreage and function and habitat roles down the road. 20 years they'll use my data to say, well, in Pleasant Bay, Ryder's Cove was crashing in 2008, but it's getting back to the 1995 area. So I agree with you that trying to validate these numbers is very important.
Yeah, I agree, Charlie. I think it's very important to try and validate them. One of the things that we've been playing with is the use of hyperspectral imagery as a way to get more quantitative assessment.